think if it wasn't for my wife and now my three kids, that I don't know if I would have the drive and the ambition to do it. You know what I mean? Like, I think in some way I'm doing a lot of it for them too, you know, just to make sure that my kids, you know, see that, you know, yeah, you can do something like that. Cause I didn't think business was possible. I always thought that, you know, starting your own business was something that only certain people could do, but in reality, anyone can do it. And it's, you just have to do it.
Welcome to the We Are Photographers podcast from Creative Live. I'm your host, Kenna Klosterman, bringing you true stories from behind the lens and behind the lives of your favorite photographers, filmmakers, and creative industry game changers. From their struggles to their wins, we get the real human stories about why they do what they do. I believe there is something to learn from everyone's story. Listen, get inspired, and discover why, in the end, your creative journey is all worth it. This is We Are Photographers, and these are our stories. I am thrilled to bring on Mr. Blake Rudess. Blake is the founder of the F64 Academy. You may know him for his YouTube channel and tutorials education. He is a landscape photographer, a self-published author. He has had a fantastic career, not just in photography, prior to that, he is a printmaker, classically trained artist, sculpture, painting, and fun fact, almost 20 years in the Air Force National Guard. He jumps out of planes and parachutes, and there are so many things I want to talk to him about. So please help me welcome Blake Rudess. Thank you so much for being here, Blake.
Thank you so much. It's an honor.
Awesome. Well, I am just excited to dive into sort of your life story. I think I just mentioned painting, sculpting, photography, and jumping out of planes and parachutes. First of all, before I even start, thank you for your service. Is it almost 20 years?
Yeah, it's I just crossed the 19-year line, and November will be 20. So yeah, crazy.
Well, we'll go into that in a little bit because everyone likes to talk about jumping out of planes and parachutes. I mean, who doesn't? But let's start with what is the most exciting thing that you are working on now? I mean, I mentioned F64 Academy. You're an internet entrepreneur. But you find so much joy in teaching because you are an amazing teacher. We've had you here on Creative Live. And so just tell us about what excites you the most right now.
Right now, you know, I like to get ultra nerdy with like the photography and Photoshop workflow stuff. So, you know, I'm kind of going back to basics right now and working in, you know, raw editors like Adobe Camera and Lightroom and trying to turn them into like these ultra efficient workflow beasts. So you'd think something simple like, you know, raw workflow should be pretty easy. It's a bunch of sliders. It does this, it does that. But I'm trying to turn it into like Frankenstein it together into this incredible thing by using profiles and presets combined that speak to one another in a really well conducive workflow. So I've been really nerding out on Adobe Camera Raw and trying to figure out what happens where and in the process in the layer stack. So that's me. I'm a big dork in a nutshell. So.
Well, I think all of us consider ourselves that way with regard to photographers, photo nerds, geeking out, but also cool.
Yeah, it's fun. I love it.
What I find interesting about you is that you you're very into the process, like you said itself, and there's, you know, photography, obviously genres run the gamut. I know that your, you know, landscape photography was kind of your thing, but you kind of have taken it to a different mental level, if you will. That's the artistic and mental, because you have an art background. So, like, right. what is it about the like color theory or that it's not just the image itself that you're kind of pushing the boundaries? Like, how did that start? Or what is it why do you invest so much time in that aspect of it?
I think I've always just kind of wanted to know why and how things work. You know, it's not enough for me to move a shadow slider. And I want to know what the shadows are, you know, and I like to dig real deep. I'm kind of like every boy probably who took apart a radio. And even though I put it back together, it might not have worked, but at least I knew what happened when I turned the volume knob. in the background. You know what I mean? And that's the whole fun in it. It's not enough to just say, okay, well, here's what contrast is. What does contrast do? And at what point of the workflow does that take place? So for me, it really, I get a lot of joy out of making hypotheses and experiments that drill down and actually come up with an answer in the end. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, I don't come up with an answer in the end. I just show people my highlight reel like Facebook, you know. But at the end of the day, I just sitting in Adobe Camera Raw, Photoshop, whatever that might be, just fills my cup, I guess.
It seems like left brain and right brain. That's like the engineering side. But when you say like you're a classically trained artist, painting, sculpting, you know, printmaking, those two things sometimes like people don't think of those in the same way. And yet, you know, creativity is all of the above. So right. I want to go back to a couple things. First of all, you said taking apart an old radio. Like, what is the first thing that you can remember sort of taking apart or, you know, tooling around with when you kind of like got interested in doing that type of thing? Like, take us back to young Blake.
Young Blake. I don't really know, because that's the hard part is like when I look back at the beginning of my art career, I know I was like 12 years old, and I remember walking through the base exchange or the BX. Most people would know that in the military. With my dad, and I saw this old set of oil paints or, you know, on the thing. I said, I want to start painting. He goes, okay, we'll grab them, and started painting and doing that kind of thing. But I also liked Legos and, you know, making things work that don't seem like they should work. So I think the dichotomy probably roots in itself in the fact that I'm a Gemini. So I've always got this dichotomy going on of, you know, the duality or the two, I don't really, you know, describe much to that, but I guess it has something to say, because when I had this old art teacher and she goes, you're a Gemini, aren't you? And I was like, yeah. She goes, that's why I don't like you. And I was like, oh, okay, well, I'm not one of those people, but you know, there are some that do prescribe to that. And I guess that is what it is. But it's funny that you say that, because when I was in college, I was obviously a fine art printmaker. But of course, in art school, there's the two camps. There's the fine artists and the visual communications majors, you know, and then they're basically polar opposites of one another. The fine artists do things for themselves, the VC do them for other people. That was kind of the idea. So there's always kind of a battle between VC and fine art, at least at the University of Delaware. I'm not sure if it's the same way now. But it was funny because I'm also a PC user, and I was also really good at Photoshop. So all the VC people would make fun of me for being a painter and a printmaker, but then they'd be like, hey, can you show me how to do this in Photoshop? And then I would show them on their Mac, and they'd be like, don't you use PC? And it's like, it doesn't really matter. It's just, it's getting to the end result, you know? So however you get there, whether you do it with the highly technical concept or with that creative concept, when you merge the two, I mean, the powers are pretty strong. I don't really think that there's a left brain, right brain. And one of the things I'm researching now is neuroscience, and they've actually discovered that that's kind of non-existent. So I think it's really cool when you dive into that and say, I'm not going to label myself left. I'm not going to label myself right. And you just get to be both. It's pretty incredible.
I love that. I mean, because in so many things in life and the world, we label things as black and white, or, you know, and yet like there's so much gray and spectrum of, you know, aspects, whether it's are you an introvert or an extrovert, you know, and there's just like, you can be, I love that. Okay. So I want to dive more into the neuroscience part, because sure, I find that fascinating. And again, when we think about the root of creativity and, you know, how the brain works, or how we can use creativity for healing, or, you know, there's just so many things. So
right,
tell me more about what you mean about the right brain, left brain, and finding that that's not really necessarily a thing.
So one of the things that I've always been confronted with, and, you know, I'm going to talk about kind of like the demographic of individuals that have found me through my education, is typically older individuals that are retired hobbyists that take great travel photos and they go all over the place, and then they want to make their photos better. So they come to me and they ask me questions, and then ultimately sometimes they come down to this answer where they say, well, of course it works that way for you because you're an artist. Or of course it works that way for you because you've been digging into your artistic personality since you were 5 years old or whatever that might be. But there's something about that whole artistic vision thing. And everyone thinks it's this like mystical, ethereal ball of light that exists inside of you. And it's so amazing and it inspires you to do things. And I think that's a bunch of horse crap. And the reason why is because, you know, when I was in art school, you know, you have a 3-month semester, 4-month semester, you don't have a whole lot of time to hope and pray and wish that something is going to come to you. You have to make it come to you. And if it doesn't come to you, it reflects in your grades. So it was always very high tempo in school to make sure that you always produce the best work that you could possibly create. But if you tried to rely on something ethereal and mystical that is going to give you that inspiration, it's not going to happen. And I think a lot of people try to do that. They're like, oh, I'm just going to wait for the inspiration to come. And it doesn't. Like, we have that power in our brain. So one of the things I've been researching, it's a course I'm going to produce hopefully this year. It's the neuroscience of artistic vision. And it's really, there's nothing really out there on it. So it's kind of hard to even discuss it because I don't want to seem like I'm presumptuous and saying I know everything about my brain because I don't. I've read like probably 7 or 8, maybe 10 neuroscience books on memory and vision and all the different things that create our brain and what we see and how we perceive memories. But one of the things I'm realizing is that there are different levels to our like artistic vision cognition, if you want to, that's what I'm calling it, ABC, or yeah, artistic vision cognition. So in those levels, there's like 4 different levels that I've kind of come up with. And a lot of times we're aware of the fact that artistic vision exists, and that's like level 1. And level 4 is, I know what parts of my brain I need to tap into to get there and do it consistently. So as an educator, I don't have the opportunity to just hope that one of my courses is going to be good. I have to make it good. I don't have the opportunity to hope that one of my images is going to go to social media and be good. I have to make it good. So a lot of the research that I'm doing is finding that the brain has the capability of doing so many different things that we don't even realize are happening. And you've probably heard people say that we only use 10% of our brain. That's like, that's also horse crap. So we, in the scheme of things, we use our brain, but there's many different facets of our brain and how that is used. But I'm going to use that as an example. So if everyone says that we use 10% of our brain, if I could just use even 10% more of that 10% and be at 11%, you're pretty dang smart. You know what I mean? Like that 1% more of that 10%, just add it on there and it's pretty good. But some of the things that I was looking at in that research that kind of debunks the whole myth of the compartmentalized portions of the brain. Yes, there are certain portions of your brain that will do certain things, but blind people, for instance, their occipital lobe, which is one of the biggest lobes in your brain, doesn't stop working just because you can't see with your eyes. It'll actually pick up the slack of some of the other parts of the brain and say, well, hold on a second. I'm not sitting here doing nothing. I'm going to go ahead and help you smell, help you see, help you taste, help you touch. So where we say they have heightened senses in other places, it might not necessarily be heightened senses in other places. It's just the fact that they've got this larger portion of their brain that's helping them do so many different things.
Wow. I love it. I find it all so fascinating. And the fact that, again, like fMRIs, like that, again, that we can study this now in, right. And I mean, just the concept of like, oh, I'm not seeing. And so that part of the brain is going to now take over some other duties. It reminds us of what an incredible, thing it is to be alive, you know, as humans. Right. And there is the some things we won't ever understand, you know, but then when we do, it kind of like layers our understanding, I guess, if you will. Right. But I want to go back to this concept of you have to like make it work. When you were talking about, you know, if I can't just hope that somebody's going to like this video, or, you know, because it's your business, you know, or, right. or what have you. So it's kind of different layers of why you need to make something work. But so how have you approached, just in life in general, this sort of like test and learn, because it's in order to figure out how to like logically make something work, you know, you probably didn't always get it right from the first go.
Right. I think, it's kind of like leadership in a way that there's different categories and different characteristics that you kind of aspire to want in a leader. You know, I hear this a lot because I do interviews and stuff with people in the National Guard, but the common question that people say is, what are the best character traits of a leader? And, you think of like trust and you think of all these different things that you want, but there's these little tiny little things that I think are kind of almost more important. Like, yes, of course we want to trust our leadership. We want to have respect them, but there's things like discipline and tenacity that are just like, those are the building blocks that are sometimes more key. So I think for me, it ends up being a discipline thing. It's like, when I come down into my office is underneath our master bedroom. I have to go outside the house to get into it. So if I come down to this office, no one's watching me. I could do anything I want. I could play video games. I could nap on my couch in the back. I could do all kinds of things if I wanted to. But it's more the discipline to say, no, I'm gonna research this. And no, I'm gonna dig into this. No, I'm gonna make sure I can come up with this next best thing and constantly challenge myself. And that's where the tenacity comes in. It's like, no, there's something better. There's something better. There's something more. And you keep pushing for it. And those are, I think, kind of the qualities that kind of keep me going. It's just, pushing myself to go to those next limits. I know for a fact that the stuff that I do with my YouTube channel or the art that I create, it's not just going to create itself. So if I don't have the tenacity to go out there and pursue it, and I don't have the discipline to continue to push myself to do it, it's just not going to happen. It's a willpower thing too. You can tie all those things together. So I think that's probably what it boils down to.
Well, I think those are, like you said, to be able to identify sort of these two characteristics that make a leader is very important, because then when you can acknowledge what you are setting out to do or be, then you kind of have a point to keep yourself accountable to. But I'm curious if you always had discipline and tenacity, like, are those learned skills? If so, like, take us back to when you didn't have the discipline.
I can take it back, because so I joined the National Guard when I was 19 and I was going to school, and it was one of those things where, it comes up and you look at the bill and it's like, yeah, how are we going to be able to make this one work? And at the time I was actually going to school for like an English teacher, because I thought that that's what I wanted to do. So my buddy joined the National Guard, the Air Force National Guard in Delaware. And I said, well, I guess if that's how you're going to pay for school, I guess I can do that too. So, but my dad was 24 years active duty, Air Force as well. And I kind of, nothing against my parents or how that went, but I kind of rejected the military as being my path. I was like, no way, I'm not doing it. I mean, as a kid, I had long hair that was shaved underneath, it was like down to here. I was like one of those punk kids. But I had no desire to be in the military. But at the same time, I didn't really have a whole lot of confidence. I didn't have confidence in myself. I didn't really have any goals for myself. I always wanted to have more, but I think it took becoming a part of something bigger in order to give me that thing that I needed for that confidence. But that's a lot of where that discipline comes from. I mean, there's a lot of things that we do in the Air Force that most civilians would be like, you did what? For what? Why? For how long? Like, you slept in the woods for 6 days and ate bugs. That's ridiculous. Why would you do something like that? But that's what you do. And you get through it, and you know that there's going to be an end. And I think that there's a series of things that happened throughout my military career that have just led from one discipline level to another that have helped build and shape that, I think, and I haven't really spent much time in the civilian adult world. I mean, I definitely did a lot, and like, I worked in a movie theater and a video store before, but one of the things that's in the military is that we have, very deliberate ways of rewarding people and awarding people. And sometimes you do things to get to that next level. So you have to continually push yourself and challenge yourself to get to that next level. And then you're rewarded for it with like a document or a little accoutrement that goes on your uniform that shows other people what you've done. So there is this kind of like chasing success type of thing that comes with that too, that I'm sure has somehow transpired into my civilian entrepreneurial life. So I know that they're connected. They have to be connected, because the who I was before I joined the National Guard versus who I am now are, you know, two completely different things. And, you know, it's good. I wouldn't take it back. You know, if I did go back, I'd do it all over again. So.
No regrets.
No.
It's kind of it's a good way to be, you know, no matter what sort of mistakes we've made or what have you. It's, you know, when we live focused on the past, it can, again, block us from that discipline and tenacity moving forward. Right. I mean, I'm curious. I'm so curious as to more of that, this discipline and the like reaching for the next goal. Are you a person who like wears the watch where you're tracking yourself or your steps or your, it's one thing when you're doing it for other people, you know, for recognition or what have you, but do you do that in other aspects of your life than your work as well? I'm not the like person who tracks my steps, or I feel like that's going to stress me out, but I feel right. like it's like two camps of people.
You know, when it comes to that stuff, I don't, but I have spreadsheets for spreadsheets for spreadsheets that track many different things. Like, you know, I don't like to just look at whatever analytics something will give me. Like YouTube, for instance, gives you great analytics, but it doesn't give you like a 10-year perspective. So I've built another spreadsheet that takes that data that shows me a big like 30,000 foot perspective on what it has looked like over that course of time. So, you know, I don't necessarily track my steps or, you know, my fitness goals or anything like that. And I'm absolutely horrible with time. As you've noticed, when we were going through this, I was like, oh my gosh, we're going to be doing this at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I was freaking out. I told my wife and she's like, you know, it's not that big of a deal. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Well, I was doing my time changes differently. It's like, hold on a second. Like I can do some chaos math and some insane analytics spreadsheets, but the Central time to Pacific time ruins me.
Pacific time is earlier than Central time. Like,
I was like, well, I guess I'm waking up at 8 o'clock, you know, and doing this interview.
I wouldn't do that to you.
Then I started thinking from a marketing perspective, like, why would they do that? 8 o'clock in the morning Central time is not a good time.
Oh, that's funny. But it's, again, like going back to, okay, now you need to do a deep dive on what part of your brain.
Exactly.
Like, you know, doesn't calculate that part in a different way. Okay. Right. I want to go back to, you just said 30,000 from the 30,000 foot level. What's the highest elevation that you've jumped out of a plane?
So I was a parachute rigger for pararescue guys. So my job was actually to jump or to pack the parachutes for them so they could jump out. So I jumped about 3 times with them. And I think the highest I jumped was maybe 10,000 feet. It wasn't too high. Anything higher than that, then you have to do halo jumps where you're on, you know, oxygen and stuff like that.
Right.
You know, it wasn't high. I mean, I jumped 3 times, but I was connected to somebody, and it was more of like a, like, it was funny because we'd be in there packing parachutes and someone would walk in and be like, hey, so-and-so needs a jump qual. We need to put a body on us. Who's coming? And it was like, well, I guess I'll go, you know, like, gets to jump out of an airplane for their job, you know. It was kind of fun, but, I loved working for those guys. We had so much fun.
Well, it takes a certain person to sign up to be the person who's jumping out of airplanes, you know, left, right, and center. And I mean, I just can imagine that being the rigger would just take a lot of, like, you got to make sure you've got everything packed properly. Cause again, it's like life or death. Again, discipline.
Yeah, that's an attention to detail thing. And I know that that has also kind of come into what I do now. And actually, part of what I was doing when I was in the military was helping them with their manuals to make better parachute manuals that would work for everyone. So this is long before I was even a halfway decent photographer or an educator or anything. But I was helping them develop Air National Guard manuals for packing the parachute so that we could streamline the parachute pack process for all the National Guard. So I was taking the pictures, writing all the documents, sending it to the manufacturer who would then put the manual together. So I was basically writing ebooks before I even realized that was going to be my life. You know, it's kind of weird.
Well,
but attention to detail is huge. So
it's interesting to be able to look back and see, you know, those paths where, you know, what connects the dots, where you can't always see that, obviously, when you're looking into the future. So,
right.
So going back to that, you just mentioned your ebooks, take us back to your kind of early on in terms of creating a YouTube channel, blogging, ebooks. Like, tell us about that evolution from, like, what did you first start when you first started your photography journey? Because you landed on photography and then you went,
right,
here, I'm doing it.
It's funny because, like, I talk to my wife about this a lot, and how all the parts and pieces kind of come together. I mean, there's definitely things that are divine appointments that happen in your life. And at my career that I'm doing now was nothing short of divine appointments for every aspect. The first time I deployed to Afghanistan, and I was freaked out about it, obviously, because I'm about to go to war in 2007. And, you know, I was a young guy. And it's funny because my boss at the time was like, hey, you never know, you might meet your future wife out there. And I was like, yeah, whatever, that's not happening. Well, I did. I ended up meeting my wife on the airplane. She was deploying with us too. And then she saw that I was really into photography when we came back. And she was really good at tactically pushing me in the direction of photography. So here I was, and I was working for Pararescue. I was working out sometimes 2-3 times a day. I think my neck was about the same size as my face. And she goes, I want you to do this photo walk thing. It's in Sausalito. And I was like, I don't know. Because we lived out in the Bay Area at the time. And I was like, I don't know what a photo walk is. And she goes, I don't know, just sign up for it. We'll go have dinner, maybe stay out there and it'll be fun. I was like, okay, whatever. So she signs me up for Kelby's photo walk in 2010. And the guy who was running it was this guy named Matt. So I go there and I get out of the car and there's like 50 other photographers there. And this guy introduces himself. He's like, hey, Matt. And I was like, I'm Blake. So we're walking together and we're shooting. He goes, what are you doing? I was like, I'm taking HDR photos. He goes, like that? And I was like, well, yeah, I do it manually. Cause I didn't even know what I was doing, man. I was like, you know, just taking pictures. And here I was more into parachutes than I was, you know, taking pictures. And he goes, well, that's an interesting way to do that. So here I am teaching this guy who doesn't have a camera, mind you, for some reason. Like, who comes on a photo walk and doesn't have a camera? Well, it turns out it was Matt Laskowski. And he's like, you should come to Photoshop World. And I was like, Photoshop World? So I get in my car and my wife says, what are you guys talking about? So we're talking about Photoshop World. And she goes, what's that? I said, I don't know. But he said that if I want to go, he'll see if he can help me out. So I reached out to him and he was like, yeah, you know, come on out, it'll be fun. And so he gave me more information on it. And I drove out to Vegas and here I was like driving there. I'm like, I'm about to go to this giant nerd convention like again, because here I was the guy who was working out like 3 times a day instead of taking pictures. And then when I got there, I saw that there was people that actually made a living off of teaching Photoshop. And I was like, this is the coolest job in the world. I was like, I gotta be one of these people. Like, this is amazing. So I saw Matt out in the lobby and he was like, hey Blake, how's your wife? And how's your kids? Like, dude, you never told me you were like this dude. Like, he's like, oh, I want friends, not followers, man. And Matt's going to kill me because I'm telling the story. Because it turns out now we're like best friends. It's funny. But so, you know, I said, I'm thinking about starting a blog. He's like, oh, you should do it. You should do it. Your work's great. Start an HDR blog. So I did. So I started a blog called everydayhdr.com. I was drinking the HDR Kool-Aid like everybody else was at the time. And at the time, you know, we kind of had to do that because our cameras couldn't do the stuff that they do now. So HDR was almost a necessity. And at the time, there also, back in 2010, wasn't a whole lot of educational stuff out there. So it was really a means to an end. I started a blog just to kind of document where I'd went and my travels, which turned into people asking me how I was doing what I was doing, which I was flattered, of course. Then they wanted tutorials and then they wanted to, you know, pay me money for ebooks and then they wanted courses and then they wanted. So I was like, okay, well, let me just keep producing and see what I come up with here. But then in like 2016, I went to apply to be an educator at out of Chicago. And Chris, my good friend, Chris Smith there, he was like, hey, Blake, I'd love to have you here, but HDR is kind of dead. And I was like, oh, no. So I quickly rebranded in January of 2016 to F64 Academy, and kind of shifted my focus a little bit to be less about just random tutorials here and there, and more about this laser focused, tack sharp, tutorial driven stuff that dug really deep into the weeds of stuff. When you look at F64, I mean, some people make fun of it. They're like, we can't even shoot at F64. And I guess you could if you still shot medium format or something like that. But, you know, it's just about taking a really deep dive, laser focused view at those things. But I'll tell you that, you know, when it comes to the discipline and tenacity behind that stuff, I think if it wasn't for my wife and now my three kids, that I don't know if I would have the drive and the ambition to do it. You know what I mean? Like, I think in some way I'm doing a lot of it for them too, you know, just to make sure that my kids, you know, see that, you know, yeah, you can do something like that. Cause I didn't think business was possible. I always thought that, you know, starting your own business was something that only certain people could do, but in reality, anyone can do it. And it's, you just have to do it.
Right. You just have to do it. I mean, there's a lot, there's a lot more than that, but not really. I mean, no. You know, it's like if you do have that single focus in F64 and you take the steps and, you know, the information is out there, but it's the people that, you know, show up again and again and again that and do the work, as we talk about a lot, that often is the, you know, the better signifier of success than actual creative talent, right. You know, because it there's so many different factors. First of all, tell us about your boys. How old are they now?
I have three boys, 9, 6, and 3. So they have kept our lives really interesting and fun during the, you know, the pandemic stuff. It was actually great. We, you know, my life has been very much like the pandemic for the last 7 years. So, I mean, I was talking, my wife and I are watching a TV show on Netflix. I think it's called Imposters or something like that. So, you know, what's funny is if somebody were to put a mark on me and follow me and watch me, they'd be like, this dude doesn't go anywhere. He just sits in his house and maybe goes to the chiropractor every week. Like, he does not. So, you know, it's been nice when they were home for, you know, school and stuff. At first, it was some adjustment period, but it was great to just be able to be with the family that whole time, you know, and at breakfast, lunch, and dinner, we're all here and doing our thing. So it was a nice break to my life because I end up being my poor wife on the other hand, though. she had to do the school stuff, but. Yeah, it was good.
It's a lot, yeah. But I'm glad to hear you guys are doing well through all of that. What is the hardest lesson for you in becoming an entrepreneur? I mean, you mentioned like it's not something you ever thought that you could do, that it was some other type of person that was able to do that. Like, was there a particular lesson that you learned that you were then said to yourself, I think I can do this. I survived this lesson, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, seriously, I think there's, like I said, there's a lot of divine appointments. There's a lot of things that had to line up in order for it to happen. But also I think having the faith to believe in the fact that no matter what, I wasn't going to fail. And not a lot of, it's hard to go into that unless you have a very strong faith. Now we're centered very strongly in our Christian faith. But, you know, in 2014, I think it was 2014, so it's been almost 7 years, I had done a webinar and I was miserable in my job. I mean, absolutely miserable. I'm a hard charger. So like I was working at this certain shop that I was in at the Air Force Base. And there was one individual that did not want me to go any further. And he had the power to make sure I couldn't go any further. So it was kind of like one of those things where if you have a bigger brother, my older brother, he would always put his hand on my forehead and I'd just be swinging and I couldn't hit him. I could be swinging as hard as I wanted to, but I could just never break that wall. And that's kind of what I was going through there. And in 2014, I had a webinar with a software company. And after the webinar, I was like, look, babe, like look at my PayPal account. I think we can make this work. And, you know, in 2010, when I started my blog, I told my wife, I said, this is gonna be something that I don't know what it's going to lead to. I don't know where it's going to go, but I have a strong feeling that this could be my life and our life. But we're going to have to make some sacrifices. And that might be maybe less time, you know, hanging out because I might have to blog or something like that, or go here, or go there. And, you know, she was totally cool with it, 100% supportive. But it was every time I was like, man, I just want to quit my job. She would always say, it's not the right time. It's not the right time. It's not the right time. And then when I showed her that, she goes, quit your job tomorrow. And I was like, no, I can't do that. But, you know, she was very supportive of it. And she said, well, we can make it work if you put in your 2 weeks, you know, and you get your 2 weeks of leave. And then maybe we, you know, look at your, because I had this thing called a thrift savings plan that was a nest egg that I was building through the Air Force retirement program. So I was like, well, maybe if I take that out, we could pay off that, do this, do that. We made all the parts work. We looked at the analytics behind it. We said, I guess this is go time, you know? So I did, I quit my job and, but it was hard. For the first like 3 or 4 months, I couldn't figure out internet entrepreneurship. And I almost got to the point where the point of failure really, where it was like, I brought this list of 10 courses to my wife and I said, look, if one of these doesn't succeed in the next 3 weeks, I'm going to have to find a job. And you know, I'm not going back to my other job. So she goes, okay, we'll talk it through. So I was talking through them and she goes, well, what's the last one? I said, well, the last one's this color theory for photographers course. And she's like, well, why not? Why is that number 10? And I was like, because no one wants to know that stuff. Here I am, so naive, you know? So that's like what I've built my business on these days. But so she's like, well, which one can you do the fastest? I said, well, this one, I could just use all my painting knowledge and I can put this together in a matter of 2 weeks and I could put it out there and I would be good to go. And she goes, well, why don't you just do that? I said, I'm like, well, I guess I'll try and do that. So I did. I put that together and that course ended up being very successful. Also, it was one of the courses I taught on Creative Live a couple of years later. But, you know, it's just that faith concept of just saying, okay, these are the messages I've received. This is what you want me to do. This is the gifts that you've given me. And this is where you want me to go with this. Okay. You know, I honestly, I don't think God intended us to be 9-to-5 type of people. I think he intended us to be the type of people that take our gifts and steward our gifts and show those gifts to other people. And it honestly, it's living proof that it works. So
I think the hardest part is, like you said, it's that faith, but it's making that go decision. You know, like you said, you having your wife saying, no, this is it and help and talk through it. But you still had to say like, okay, and start. I think a lot of people, including myself, get stuck on the taking the first step because you don't know what the outcome's going to be. And so I think that really is the differentiator, is being able to, it's not blind faith, but it is like, it is faith.
I think if you look at if you try to look at my business that I've been doing for, you know, 11 years, if you want to count the first, you know, 4 years of that blog, if you try to take all of that and someone tries to look at that and says, oh, I can do that and sees all the parts, it's going to flatten them. There's no way. It's like looking at the universe and this universal concept of everything that's out there and saying to yourself, wow, I'm so minuscule. And then you get to the point where you just beat yourself up because all the parts aren't working. All the parts aren't supposed to work in the beginning. You're supposed to fail, but you're supposed to learn through those failures and say, okay, I failed here. What did I learn from this? Like the first 4 products that I put out that nobody bought at all, not one sale. It was like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to fail here. But that you look at those we have this thing in the military, we call a hot wash and we do them pretty much after every mission. One of those things that we look at the mission, we look at where we succeeded, but we don't look at the successes and gloat on our successes. We say, no, we succeeded here, but that hot wash is about the 90%. 90% of it is about what could we do better for the next time, not the 10% of the success. So I kind of take that into my business now too, where it's like, okay, yeah, that was a successful launch. What worked? Okay, that worked, but what could you have done better? And there's never a launch of any product that I do now where I don't look at what could I have done better and don't incorporate into the next one and the next one and the next one. So that by the time you get, if you keep doing that, you keep forcing yourself, that of course it adds to that discipline concept, but it makes that finished product more refined. It makes it better. You know, hearing comments that people say like, oh, your audio quality is really not that great. Like you should probably work on that. Well, maybe I need a new microphone. Okay, check, I'll take it. I'm not going to take it as a personal attack. I'm going to take it as my audio sucks. Let me go get a new microphone. So, you know.
Well, it's, you know, there's so many levels, like you just said, of the discipline aspects of that. And a lot of people don't have the discipline of analyzing what works and what doesn't. Right. And I think that's huge. I mean, I don't prescribe to be somebody that does that well, because you're, you know, often you're just like wanting to move on to the next thing without making the time to truly look at what were the aspects of what works and what didn't. What were the classes that, I mean, I can only imagine the crushing feeling of putting four things out and not one person buying them. What was the lesson that you learned from the next iteration of that?
Well, I think, you know, like the first two or three were like little action packs for Photoshop. And back then people weren't really into actions. Even now people aren't really, I mean, that's really like the power user kind of stuff. So I was taking the things that I was doing and thinking that people wanted what I was doing. But in reality, I wasn't listening to what people wanted and helping them with what they wanted. So I had put this giant package together on this critique session thing that I was thinking. So I told my wife, I said, look, if I can get 10 people to pay me $250 a month, we could possibly get, and not those same 10, but 10 people every month to pay $250 to do critique sessions. I'm going to do 3 hours with them. I'm going to take an hour to look at it, an hour to go back with them. And then all of it will be recorded. So that's a steal for $250. Like, that's amazing. Well, what I didn't realize back then is that, you know, you have to kind of make people believe that they need that. and I didn't know how to do that. I didn't know how to say, well, here's what I learned in college about how my artwork got better. And here's how I can help you make yours better. It was just, let me put this product out there, not tell them why they need it, and they'll buy it because it's there. And that's not the case. Just because something exists doesn't mean we want it or need it. You have to help people and show them why they're going to need it. And you're not doing it. There's some people that know marketing very well and do this almost like a bait and switch, where they get you to buy something and then you're like, oh, this, I needed that so much. And then you get it and you're like, wait, this is crap. You know what I mean? So it's like Jedi mind tricks. Like, you can use this stuff for good or bad. And all it takes is one step in either direction, and you're using it for good or you're using it for the dark side. And, you know, that's kind of the concept that I take into this stuff now. It's like, yes, I need to make great products. I need to convince people and show them that this is something of value, but I need to provide on the back end. Because if it's not providing on the back end, it's never going to do anything. So once all those kind of those concepts started to come together, and I started reverse engineering my courses and building them from the end result to the beginning, and looking at that large piece that I want to accomplish, digging down and getting all the way down to the root of it, almost like taking that giant radio apart and showing all the different pieces, that's how I started building my courses forward. So it was like, let's focus on a result first. What's that result that we want to give the individual? Now let's break it down. So the first couple products that I had produced, they weren't doing that. They were just assuming that people would need something without really finding what the result was first.
Such an important lesson for any solopreneur, entrepreneur. It's one thing when you're creating for yourself, you know, it's another thing when you're creating something that you want other people to buy or appreciate or what have you. And the, just that reverse engineering of breaking it down to what do people need and want,
right?
Whether no matter what type of a photographer, filmmaker, business owner that you are, identifying that target market, you know, who they are, what they look for, what they want. Talk to me about, because I know you do a lot of critiquing. So was your solution to put it like, to show people the value of critique by doing it at a mass scale?
Yeah. So what I do now is, and I've been doing this. So when I did Everyday HDR, I had a subscription website that I called HDR Insider. So I realized that trying to get someone to spend $250 on something they didn't think that they needed wasn't going to work. So I built a subscription model that would basically take the masses into this subscription model, allow them to upload their pictures, what they considered a finished image, to the website. And then I would pull those down at the end of it. Well, now I do it twice a month. I do two 12 image critique sessions. So 24 images per month. And I've been doing this, I've probably critiqued maybe 1500 images at this point, but I don't critique like normal people do. So and this is probably giving away the farm to other educators out there, but whatever. So what I do is I look at the image, and I even tell people, like, I'm going to put my viewer hat on. This is what I see. Okay. I like this. I like this. I like this. I'm just your casual viewer. okay, let me take that hat off. Now let me be the photographer. Now let me be Blake, who's going to dig down deep, and then let me show you how to fix it. So my critiques are, they're 5 to 10 minutes per image. And what it shows them is, the reason why I want a finished image, I don't want raw files. I don't even want to know what your perspective is. Because if you were to hang this in a gallery, what would someone see when they walked up to it? That's what I want them to see. I want them to see what the initial reaction is going to be of somebody who has no communication whatsoever with that image, so that they know, okay, because to me, I think artwork is a communication process. It's a way that I can communicate to a viewer without them talking to me. So my piece has to speak for me. Now, there's communication barriers, just like when you're talking to somebody and they don't get what you're saying, just like there is with the communication barrier within your work. So my job then becomes to help them with the communication barrier and show them what I would possibly do in Photoshop to make it better or draw more interest or pull them in. So it becomes basically like a little learning session about the image. And then it goes into a almost like a little mini YouTube tutorial on what I would do to fix it. So that's how I restructured that. And that's one of the aspects of my new website, which is f64elite.com. And that's my subscription-based website where I pull those images in. And I don't curate them based on what I like, because I don't think that would be fair. I don't curate them based on what's not working. I curate them based on what we can learn best from. So when I see all those, like there's 60 to 70 images per month come in, and I'm going to curate them down to the 24 that are going to be critiqued, I look at, okay, this one could show us how to do this. Or I've got 10 images in my portfolio right now that look like this. So pull those ones that we could all learn a lesson from, and then show those ones to the rest of the individuals on the site.
What do you find, and maybe we take it to color, because I know color theory is a big thing for you. And again, going back to being a painter, an artist, what are some of the biggest mistakes that people make?
You know, I think it really comes down to drawing the viewer's attention to what you want. Like, we see something and we connect with it. And this is another neuroscience thing. It's another brain thing. So perfect example, I was in church the other day and a gentleman comes up to me and says, "Hey, I got these great shots from my wife and I's vacation to Hawaii. You got to see the sunset." And he shows it to me. And I was like, "Oh, that's good." And he's like, "You're not moved by that?" And I was like, "No, I'm not moved by that at all." And he goes, "Why?" I was like, "Well, I'm going to tell you exactly why." Of course, I'm a photographer and he knows that. So I said, here's the thing. I said, "You were probably maybe sipping on a Mai Tai. You probably had your arm around your wife. Your kids were probably, you know, back at the hotel room. And you had this emotive feeling towards that sunset because of the fact that you were there with your wife and all these things that led you to this place." So the thing is that you see that when you look at that image. I don't. I see a sky that has very little color. I don't know why you didn't put something in the foreground. And he's like, "Dude, I didn't need all that." But I'm like, "No, but that's the thing." Like, so us as photographers, we have to take that into consideration, is that we, no matter where we go, no matter where, what we shoot or who we shoot, we connect with that at a brain level. You know, we're that's going to trigger some type of memory. It's then our job to translate what our emotions are into that piece to get the viewer to see what it is that we saw. I call it reverse empathy. I'm an empathetic person. So if somebody else is crying, I might start crying. But I have to now use reverse empathy where I want them to feel what I felt, which is a lot harder than just being an empathetic person, because now some people won't be moved by anything. So I think a lot of times what I see the most is that there's a disconnect between the emotions that they had and how they're communicating that with the individual that's going to see it. And of course, there's all these different techniques and stuff that you can get to do that, to draw the viewer's attention, increase color. Color theory is a big one. Color, because color affects mood. What kind of colors are you going to put in that image to create that mood? Even directing the viewer's attention with, I use a lot of gradients to do this, different gradients of color that the viewer would have no idea that you used a gradient at all. But it just kind of brings them right into the piece through whatever color choices that you might be using. And they're none the wiser. And that helps with that communication aspect. So color definitely helps with that. But I think initially it comes down to the connection of, okay, you showed me this image because you're proud of it. What do you want me to see? Because I don't see it. But now let me assume what it is that you wanted me to see, and let me help you get to that point.
I love it. I mean, that right there is the value of critique, and whether that's critique of, you know, seeing somebody else's image, where again, where we can all learn from that. But back to the neuroscience and the, I mean, for me, it's always, to your point, does, when I look at an image, do I feel, you know, right. do I feel something? It could be, you know, a perfect quote unquote image technically, you know, what have you. But if I, to your point, if I don't feel something, then it doesn't speak to me like the, you know, that, that sunset picture didn't for you. So right. what, when you're creating the image, even before you get it into that post-processing where you can tweak all these things for you, so you do photograph a lot of landscapes. It's one thing to photograph people and be like making this connection and creating, you know, in their look in their mm-hmm. eye and all that. How do you, and maybe this is my final question, how do you create emotion in the, like, is there some connection when you're capturing the image before the post-processing part that you have? But do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying, because I mean, and you know, I do that a lot. I don't actually shoot a whole lot. I'm lucky if I shoot 3 times a year, but that's just the amount of education that I put out, and that's where I find a lot more of that value for me as to what really makes me feel like I've accomplished something. Not saying that photography doesn't make me feel accomplished, but I get in these like little fits where I need to go to like this happened last year. I need to go to the Badlands, and I just went and I shot, and I slept like maybe 6 hours out of, you know, 5 days, you know, it's just like, shoot, 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 go, go Milky Way. Oh, sunrise, sunset, Milky Way, you know, like whatever, who cares? Just keep going, keep moving. So I think that for me, especially because it doesn't have to be these amazing, iconic, epic locations, you know, you can have those types of emotive responses to everything. But for me, it comes down to the fact that it's like, wow, you know, when I go to Yosemite or I go to Zion National Park and I see these things, and I'm like, it just puts me in this position where I'm like, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. And I get that connection with it. And then I go to Olympic and I'm like, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. And then I make that, and then I keep going to all these places. I'm like, how is this stuff getting more and more beautiful to me than the last one? But I think it gets down to that emotive connection that, you know, especially, you know, with the faith-based stuff, it's like, you know, there's a lot of things that are bigger than me, and how can I document this stuff and make it as gorgeous as it possibly could be, knowing that every sunset is going to be different. There's no two that are the same. Every sunrise is going to be different. No two are the same. You know, that I think alone is incredible, knowing that it doesn't, you could go to the same place 300 times at sunset and get a different picture every single time. And that's kind of the connection that I make with that. You know, there are some I say that, but at the same time, I'm also one of those people who's like, just go and collect data, you know, like my camera is a data collector and I just go and I collect data, but I'm trying to shy away from that in a way, because one of the things I'm trying to teach people is how to connect with that place, how to be in the right frame of mind to connect with that place, how to document what that connection felt like, because it could sometimes be 2 or 3 months before I go back and edit some of those images. So if I did have an emotive connection to that place, and then I come home and 2 months later I'm editing that photograph, if I don't remember or have somewhere documented what that emotive connection was while I was there, then it all just kind of falls apart and I don't have that connection. And those are the images that don't work out to be as good. So what I've gotten to now is either I take a little voice recorder with me, like one of these little Zoom recorders, and I just pin that on while I'm shooting and I just talk in it, you know, or I have a little notepad that I carry in my thing. And as I'm, again, we're landscape photographers. We wait for nothing sometimes. So I sit there for like 2 hours waiting for a sunset. People think you're a fool, but you know, it's therapeutic in a way. So I'll take notes and I'll take documents about the things that I'm seeing around me, so that when I go to photograph that, I mean, I go so far as, you know, tapping into all the senses. You know, I probably have more candles than my wife does upstairs in my office, because I grab one based on what it is that I've shot. And I kind of smell that while I'm editing, so that even though it's not the same smell, it's a contrived smell, obviously, but it gets me into that place. It gets me into that mindset to help elaborate on that emotive communication. So there's different tips and there's different strategies that you can use that will get you that emotive connection that you need to have, even while you're in the post-processing phase. And that's why I can only edit right here. I can't edit on my laptop. I can't edit on an iPad. I can't do any of that stuff. I want to be in my Zen place with my Zen music, with my Zen candle, and I get there.
Wow. I think that's the most fascinating answer about emoting landscape photography that I've heard. And with the coming back around to making that, how to make that connection again for yourself when you sit down to process that image. Okay. What's your favorite candle, not flavor, but smell, but you know what I mean? What's your go-to?
Yankee. It's a balsam and cedar. It's amazing. Total man candle too, but it's
total man candle. That's a total man candle, but out into nature.
It's better than whiskey, right? But
Blake, it has been so awesome to have you on We Are Photographers and dive a little bit further into your past and what makes you tick. I love all the brain conversation. We have had a ton of people tuning in and letting us know where they are tuning in from. So I want to give some of those shout outs. Shannon in Oregon. Terry is saying a voice recorder to help jumpstart an image 2 months later. I love this idea. We have Arnaldo, who's been tuning in from Nicaragua, Poland, Virginia, wow. Spain, Canada, UK, sit right here, Seattle, North Yorkshire, New Jersey, London. Love it. Thank you, everybody, awesome. For tuning in for the live event. Blake, where can everybody find you, follow you, and find out more about what you do?
Well, the benefit of having a name like Blake Rudess is you can just Google me and you'll find whatever you need. But f64academy.com is basically my main squeeze. So that's the place to kind of follow me and keep up. YouTube, F64 Academy there as well. I try to put out a new video every week, but sometimes I take a break because I've got 3 kids and crazy life. But that's it.
And that's okay.
Yep. I love it.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll see you all next time right here on Creative Live. If you are listening to the audio version, you can subscribe, rate, review anywhere that it is that you get your podcasts. And of course, we live stream here on Creative Live TV. You can check out all the former episodes of the variety of things that we bring you on Creative Live TV. So thank you so much again, everybody, for tuning in. And thank you to Blake Rudess. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
I'm Kenna Klosterman, and you've been listening to the We Are Photographers podcast from Creative Live. At Creative Live, we believe there's a creator in all of us. And yes, that means you. If you're looking to get fresh perspectives, inspiration, or skills to boost your hobbies, business, or life, head over to creativelive.com and check out the Creator Pass. That's our subscription that gives you access to over 1,500 classes on demand. Whether it's photo and video, art and design, craft, entrepreneurship, or personal finance, or even yoga, there is always something new to learn on Creative Live from the world's best educators. And if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review We Are Photographers wherever it is you listen to podcasts. We'd love to hear from you, and a 5-star review goes a long way. And if you like this episode, tell someone about it. Word of mouth is the best way for us to reach more creators just like you. You can stay up to date with everything happening at Creative Live by following us on social media at Creative Live everywhere. And I'm at Kenna Klosterman on Instagram and at Kenna K Photo on Twitter. If there's anyone you want us to feature on the podcast, send me a message. Thank you again for being part of the global Creative Live community. And I'll see you all next week for another episode of We Are Photographers.